supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Pennsylvania Attorney General's office is investigating the death of David Jones, fatally shot in the back by a city police officer in June. That's according to the city district attorney's office, which referred the case. Philadelphia Council President Darrell Clark first revealed the state investigation this morning when members of the group Black Lives Matter interrupted a press conference at City Hall. WHYY's Tom McDonald was there.
It was supposed to be an event unveiling Philadelphia's new plan to be litter-free by 2035. But about 2 minutes into Council President Darrell Clark's speech, two protesters, Asa Khalif and Isaac Gardner, burst into the mayor's reception room. Khalif, who says he's from the group Black Lives Matter, spoke as Gardner recorded video.
We're here to deal with the death of David Jones. We're now in the ninth week, and this is a black man who was shot and murdered by a 15th District police officer, shot in the back. It's on tape.
Back in June, police say Officer Ryan Palnull attempted to stop Jones as he was riding a dirt bike near Whitaker and Hunting Park Avenues. But after Palnull got out of his cruiser, witnesses say surveillance cameras showed Jones ditched his bike and ran, and Palnull shot him three times in the back. Police say Jones was armed, although a witness says Jones dropped his gun while he was running. Cully says activists want transparency in the investigation of Jones' death.
We don't want to keep coming here interrupting press conference for you as a council president and for the other council people to speak out about this black man who has been shot by this white officer.
Then Khalif confronted Clark, who's black, using racially charged insults and demanding the council president take a bigger stand on the issue.
Do you want to have a meeting?
I want you to say in front of everybody. No,
you're not going to dictate the terms
of our
discussion.
Well, then we're going to keep right here while you're talking.
Clark says he's been on top of the shooting.
I have talked to a number of individuals, starting with the police department, and have talked to the Attorney General. This particular issue, as you may or may not know, is going to be forwarded to the Attorney General's Office of the State of Pennsylvania for further investigation, because we anticipate that it will take away some of the issues with respect to the internal process of the police. I spoke to the Attorney General last week about this issue.
Clark says he hopes there will be a fair resolution to the state's investigation. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The press conference may have been cut short, but the city of Philadelphia still released its zero waste plan today. Joining me to provide details that did not make it to this morning's meeting is Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly. Catalina, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
The city has been trying for a long time to get rid of its litter problem. What's different about this plan?
I would say the main difference is that it includes a lot of voices. The cabinet created by Mayor Jim Kenney last December includes many city departments. So it's not only the streets department trying to figure out how to keep the streets clean, or parks and recreation coming up with ideas. The health and water departments, and even the police are involved. The cabinet also includes community organizations and businesses. Here's what the cabinet's director, Nick Esposito, told me.
This is an interdepartmental effort, and I think, you know, a lot of departments have collaborated before on this issue, but bringing this many people to the table to be able to work together to know what their stake is in the problem, what their role is in the solution, and how they're going to work with everyone else through the departments and the city government, but also the stakeholders in our communities, I think that's the real power of this plan, and it's what's going to make it different from ones previous to it.
So it's basically sitting everyone around the table to try to come up with possible solutions.
One of the main goals, obviously, is making public spaces cleaner by getting rid of litter. More trash cans would help, but beyond that, what more can the city do?
The plan includes 31 recommendations. Many of them have to do with increasing enforcement of existing regulations or improving those regulations. For example, one of the short-term priorities is increasing enforcement on disposal of mattresses and tires, two things that we see in empty lots and sidewalks all over the city. In the long term, the city wants to ban plastic bags and bring back street sweeping, which was one of Mayor Kenney's campaign promises, by the way. But I would say most of the recommendations have to do with illegal dumping, which is one of the city's and Pennsylvania's major problems. Fines for short dumpings haven't been revised since the 1980s. So this plan proposes to raise them from $300 to $2,000. Here's Nick Esposito again.
Like, this has to stop, and it's demoralizing. People clean up a lot, and then the next, sometimes later that day, it gets dumped on again. And when people see that, they just think, okay, this doesn't work. I don't care anymore. I'm not cleaning up. So we have, you know, everywhere from how do we actually catch people? So how are we taking in, you know, evidence both with through the police department, but also through residents who are capturing maybe license plates or evidence? How do we make sure that these people can get prosecuted and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law?
Catalina, let's move on to the name of the report, Zero Waste, and indeed reducing waste. Every year, Philadelphia generates some 1.5 million tons of waste, and to clean and dispose of it, the city's spending around $42 million. How can that number be reduced?
Mainly by recycling more. And when I say recycling, I include composting and other ways of reusing waste that avoid sending it to landfills or incinerators. The city currently recycles about 21% of the waste it collects every year. If you include private collection for businesses and institutions, we recycle about 40%. And the goal is to recycle 90%. So there's a long way to go. To get there, the city wants to incentivize residents to recycle more with a rewards program that would give people points that they can then use to buy things they need. And there's already legislation that requires municipal and commercial buildings to recycle, but only a few of them are complying with it. So this year, one of the first goals of the plan is to get more municipal buildings on board and lead by example.
Now, the city says it wants to do all of this by the year 2035. Is that possible?
Well, it is surely an ambitious goal. I think the fact that so many city departments and community organizations are involved will help. And of course, it depends a lot on how much everyone in the city cooperates. Mayor Jim Kenney and city officials have said that the only way this gets done is by residents getting involved. Zero starts with one, as they say.
Thanks, Catalina.
Thank you.
Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly. For the next few months, WHYY is working with news outlets around New Jersey to explore political divisions and the upcoming election of a new governor through the eyes of one neighborhood. We're calling it Voting Block, and we'll watch five different places across the state. In this installment, WNYC's Nancy Solomon reconvenes residents of Hillside Terrace in West Orange, but this time with a special guest, Democratic candidate for governor Phil Murphy.
The residents of Hillside Terrace are a largely Democratic bunch, so this was friendly territory for Murphy.
Hi, Bill.
Bill?
Nice to meet you, yes.
Bill Murphy.
What a nice night. A little warm.
It was our second block party on the back deck of Philosalo Kay's house. The neighbors were excited and deferential to the candidate. How they would speak to each other later, well, that's a whole other story.
I've never done this before, I have to say.
Neither have we.
So.
Murphy began with his usual pitch. Sure, he made a lot of money working for Goldman Sachs, but he grew up working poor, and he'll shore up the safety net, focus on investing in education, tech, and infrastructure to grow New Jersey's economy.
If we don't get the economy right, we don't get New Jersey right.
Nirmiti Shah, a Democrat who works in finance, questioned Murphy about why he wants to raise the minimum wage.
So when you work in finance, you believe in capitalism taking care of a lot of stuff. So when you say to make New Jersey fair again, why do you need political intervention when market forces can sort of deal with it?
If you earn the minimum wage in the state of New Jersey and you're a two-income household and you've got two kids, you're below the poverty line. That's why.
He goes on. People need sick leave so they don't lose their jobs when they become ill. And New Jersey has some of the worst income inequality in the nation.
I'm not trying to be compatible.
No.
I need your help. I need your vote.
No, you have my vote.
But then he pivoted to show he also believes in market solutions, calling himself a pro-growth progressive.
I want government to reignite those economies, but then get out of the way.
Ray Nutkus, who's retired and spent his career in education, wanted to know what he would do to improve improve higher education.
The state system has taken a beating. What will you do to help coordinate different industries to come back to New Jersey and help to generate skilled workers?
Murphy takes another deep dive. He wants to boost science and technology skills from vocational schools and community colleges up through advanced university degrees to modernize New Jersey's workforce and draw more industry to the state. Len Morozak, who was the lone Republican to attend, brought up Murphy's support for legalizing marijuana. He wanted to know what he would do to prevent problems like traffic deaths and more emergency room visits.
It's fine that, you know, we could all sit here and smoke a joint. We can walk home. But, you know, what do we do?
We'll strike that from the WNYC right there. Let the record out. Drink out a bottle of water.
The Republican wants to know what we're going to do after we smoke a joint and walk home.
The quick answer is it's a social justice issue for me. Biggest contributor to the white, non-white gap in persons incarcerated are low-end drug crimes.
But Murphy says he understands the concerns. But New Jersey can learn from the mistakes of states that have gone first. After Murphy left, the party moved inside as it started to rain.
That's legal.
And with Murphy gone, the group loosened up a bit.
First of all, I did not vote for him in the primary.
This is Bonnie Nutkus.
No, but I liked him. I liked everything he said tonight.
Why I think he's probably going to be a good guy. He was chosen to be an ambassador to a country. And regardless of what the background is, an ambassador is vetted quite well. There are no skeletons.
That's Arun Vadlamani, a centrist. Support from Arun and his wife Nirmati suggests Murphy is winning over moderates who like his business chops. All that decorum and agreement about Murphy faded as soon as the conversation moved to the Trump administration, especially when the conservative, Len Morozak, insisted there was no evidence the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to defeat Hillary Clinton.
Everybody's going apoplectic about the Russians.
Doesn't that bother you? He really likes Putin a lot.
So did Obama.
The argument went on from there for another 30 minutes until I declared an impasse. The debate and the heated tone took us beyond my moderating skills. So for our next meeting, I'm bringing in the experts. A fellow from the Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies has been listening to our Voting Block series and is offering to help.
WNYC's Nancy Solomon reporting. WNYC has invited the Republican candidate for governor, Kim Guadagno, to join a similar block party and is still awaiting her response. The Black Star Film Festival wrapped up yesterday in West Philadelphia by honoring director Ava DuVernay with its Richard Nichols Luminary Award. On Saturday, DuVernay sat down for a conversation about her filmmaking process before a packed house. WHYY's Annette John Hall was there.
DVD commentaries?
Director Ava DuVernay was the box office attraction at the Lightbox Theater Saturday, which isn't surprising. DuVernay's on top of her game with movies like the Oscar-nominated Selma and 13th, the hit TV series Queen Sugar, and the upcoming Disney version of A Wrinkle in Time under her belt. The line snaked around International House to see her. Waiting was Lisa Cortez, a noted producer and director in her own right, whose work with Philadelphia's Lee Daniels on such films as Precious, The Woodsman, and Shadow Boxer. Cortez credits DuVernay as a creator who empowers her community by telling stories on her own terms.
Sister wears natural hair, okay? She's up there in Hollywood, but she is up there in her queendom also.
Festival goers enjoyed more than 60 films screened over the weekend. It was paradise for seasoned film lovers like Herbert Humphrey of Atlanta.
Oh, man, I'm a black movie enthusiast. When I grew up, every Saturday was a trip to the Dollar Theater to see the old classics, the real classics, Shaft, Superfly, all of those.
Now in its sixth season, Black Star organizers say this year's four-day festival was the best attended yet. And even though DuVernay screened her film, Middle of Nowhere, here in 2012, getting her for a sit-down interview with festival founder Mayori Holmes was still a big coup. DuVernay exudes the warmth of your most creative friend. She grew up in Compton, California, and came of age in the 90s, the golden age of hip-hop. While at UCLA, she majored in African-American studies and English. Filmmaking was an afterthought. She didn't even pick up a camera until she was 32.
So I was grown, fully grown. And so I did not go into the idea of filmmaking thinking that it was going to be anything sexy. You know what I mean? I just had stories that I wanted to tell.
Those stories have especially motivated 15-year-old Anaya Wolf of Northeast Philly to pursue her passion. She's a budding filmmaker who has already started her own production company. During Saturday's Q&A, Wolf asked DuVernay for professional advice.
You've inspired me and so many other young women as well. But my question is, would you recommend it, film school? I mean, I know you didn't go, but would you say
first of all, let me say, you make my heart leap with joy. We're all so proud of you. It sounds to me like you don't need film school, but film school needs you.
Poet and author Sonia Sanchez summed up the feel-good creativity festivals like Black Star evoke.
To be here in a place called Black Star, to see all these films, my dear sister, I mean, these little short films made by young people. I mean, the genius, the talent, you know we're going to win.
Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
It's a great week to gaze aloft and take in the wonders of the night sky. Joining me to set the scene is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. And Derek, the week kicks off today.
Unbeknownst to most of our listeners, since it's not really visible to us, there was a total lunar eclipse today. It peaked this afternoon at about 2:15 local time. If you happen to be in Europe today, or Asia, Africa, Australia, you would have been able to take part in this. But it actually is the precursor to the total solar eclipse that will be visible across the entire United States 2 weeks from now on August 21st.
I'd rather take in the solar eclipse in the United States than the lunar eclipse elsewhere.
You'd get a much bigger bang for your buck, if you will. Lunar eclipses are, in some sense, more regular than solar eclipses. And I say that not with the sense of frequency, but with their area of available visibility. Solar eclipses, the totality portion, happens for specific parts of the world, very narrow bands, only be visible in its totality across a band that stretches from the west coast of the U.S. to the east coast of the U.S., but only 70 miles wide. The rest of us will experience a partial solar eclipse, whereas a lunar eclipse is visible by an entire hemisphere.
Coincidence, or is there a linkage between lunar and solar eclipses?
It's all part of the great celestial machinery of the heavens, which is precise in how its cycles match and meld and work together. What we've done here on Earth to civilize this motion is we've made it work for us in ways that are sensible, logical, and easily divisible. But for the celestial mechanics of the universe, the lunar cycles work together with our orbital motion around the sun in such a way as to provide for a lunar eclipse to either precede or follow a total solar eclipse. But you can see how it would be that if we have a total lunar eclipse on one day, if we go halfway around the planet Earth, we come around to the other side of the planet where the moon can then be in direct alignment with the sun, and we have the solar eclipse on the other half of the moon's cycle.
To whatever extent we can civilize it, it's a tougher task to tame it.
You're absolutely right. In order to properly view a solar eclipse, you must have the proper kind of eyewear, the proper kind of solar filters that will protect your eyesight from the intense light of the sun. You need to cut back the brightness of the sun by 99.98%. 99.98%.
Of course, that eyewear caveat is not necessary to view the Perseid meteor shower at the end of the week.
No, it is not. In fact, this is a great week for astronomy, not only because of the lunar eclipse tonight, but the end of this week, the Perseid meteor shower, one of the two best meteor showers of the year. Yes, there are other meteor showers, but nowhere near as impressive as the Perseid or the Geminid shower that happens in December. This shower tends to show anywhere from 60 to 100 meteors per hour if conditions are right.
What part of the night and what portion of the sky is preferred?
Well, often you'll hear people say that the best time to view a meteor shower is between midnight and sunrise. And that's because the Earth, in its rotation on its axis, is turning into the stream of meteors. However, I'd say, as soon as the sky gets dark, you can begin looking for Perseid meteors. The actual spot in the sky where it appears the meteors are coming from is among the stars of the constellation Perseus. Perseus rises at about 11 p.m. in the evening. So if you are up after 11 p.m., what you'll find is that you can look over toward the eastern side of the sky where you'll be looking directly towards Perseus, and that may help to enhance what you see of the shower. But you'll see these meteors all over the sky, and the way to check to make sure if they are Perseids is to try to track the trail that they leave back across the sky to see if it leads back over toward the east-northeast. If the trail you see seems to track back in that location, you're seeing a true Perseid shower.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.